I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Climate change anxiety is a relatively new phenomenon, and many young people are having to find ways to come to terms with it. It's altering the way some of them live their lives. Today, how young adults look at climate issues and how it's different than previous generations. Often they feel grief and guilt about how they contribute to the problem. But do they still hold out hope for a solution? And who are they turning to for that answer? Then the ethics professors are back to talk about football and the ethics of watching a sport that poses such high health risks to the players. And we'll ask how far is too far when it comes to supporting one's cause in a protest. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. While some people still question the impact of climate change, there's one group of Americans who are staring that impact straight in the face. That group is young adults who are now old enough to begin to understand how global warming could affect their futures, not to mention the futures of their children. Some young folks are opting not to have kids. Some are going vegan. Some are so concerned with what they see going on with the planet that they now struggle with deep-seated anxiety. Let's talk with some of these millennials right now. And with us, Sierra West belongs to the Sunrise Movement KC environmental group. Her day job is working for Ride KC. Sierra, good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Cole Strickland is with Citizens Lobby, the Kansas City chapter. He works for a Kansas City construction company. Cole, good morning to you.
Morning, Steve.
Emily Hurley is also with a Kansas City chapter of Citizens Lobby. She's a public health researcher and an assistant professor at Children's Mercy Hospital, UMKC, and the KU Med Center. Emily, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
So how has global warming changed your life, Sierra? What are some concrete ways you've adjusted in response to climate change? What are you doing?
Well, I have undergone a pretty dramatic transformation in the past several months. For me, this has been an issue where everything about my lifestyle as a millennial has changed. Originally started trying to achieve what I understood to be the American dream, to try to understand how I can better myself through my career, through being a professional, becoming a homeowner, owning cars. And when I achieved those goals, which I was able to, I realized that the happiness I had thought it would bring me wasn't there. And I wanted to seek the meaning that was missing from my life. And it was something that I was able to pursue by looking at what we are now facing with the climate crisis.
Cole, how about you? How has all this changed your life?
Well, this has changed my life. I haven't really move to like driving an electric car because I can't afford that. I don't ride my bike to work because that would take 2 hours. but one way I have changed is that I have found the Citizens Climate Lobby and been using that as an outlet for a way to act on this call that I've heard about climate change, because I hear about climate change every day. And I feel like it's on me to do something about it. And if I had not heard that call, I would not be involved with Citizens Climate Lobby.
Where did that call come from, Cole?
That call came from endless news reports. I read a lot of news. I'm kind of a nerd like that. I did read the Fourth National Climate Assessment by our American scientists that said that climate change is a real threat. And it will threaten a lot of people internationally. Maybe not us, because we're Americans. We have the wealth to protect ourselves from that. But that's what made me decide I needed to do something about this.
Emily, how about you?
Well, I was taking a lot of these individual actions. You know, I did manage to get a hybrid car, and it tells me every time I press on the brake how much energy I'm saving. And, you know, everyday life, just trying to reduce consumption, reduce carbon footprint. But I was getting very frustrated and very anxious that that was not going to be enough. It's just a drop in the bucket. And we live in a country where all of our systems are built around fossil fuels, and all of the way that everything operates in our daily lives is so dependent on what's polluting our earth. And that is why I got involved in Citizens Climate Lobby, Sunrise Movement as well. I think in the past year, we've seen our groups really, really grow because people are getting frustrated with the limitations of our individual actions, even mm-hmm. though we try to do our best on a daily basis. And we want to see the government take action to really help us as a country get off of fossil fuels and get our energy from cleaner sources.
And that's what Citizens Lobby is all about, pushing Citizens the government
Climate
to take
Lobby.
Action.
Yeah. Right. Citizens Climate Lobby is focused on passing a bill for carbon fee and dividend. Basically, it would be an increasing fee on all fossil fuels at the source, but that money would come directly back to citizens in a monthly check. Mm-hmm. So we would all get equal dividends that would offset the economic impact of us having to pay a little bit more for the energy we use now, but it would incentivize other alternative sources of energy to become the things on the market that we would want to buy with that money anyways. That's what we do at Citizens Climate Lobby. There's a lot of other great climate bills out there, but we really want to see action from both parties, from our federal government, and we really want to see it soon because, as we saw with this, you know, report that recently came out from the IPCC, we have this 12-year window to do something before most of these right. effects we see are irreversible.
You know, I'm wondering about some of the really basic things here, like, you know, Cole mentioned biking to work, showering less, hanging up the laundry instead of using a dryer. Are those things sort of on your plate these days?
Absolutely. And we can individually make a lot of decisions that will reduce our emissions, CO2 emissions, reduce our carbon footprint. But ultimately, even when we're choosing to vote with our dollar, we have to understand that approximately 70% of CO2 emissions are being produced by corporations. This requires us as individuals to unite in a voice together. That's what the Sunrise Movement attempts to do.
Yeah.
We are uniting young people in a movement that says we cannot face the climate crisis alone. We can't face it individually. We have to face it together and demand that politicians who may have been hesitant to agree with proposals such as the Green New Deal, to make them reconsider that position.
How big is the Sunrise Movement in Kansas City right now? How many members do you have?
Well, we started up last March, and every 5 to 6 weeks we've been doubling. And now as a part of our Slack message app, which goes out to all of the pretty solid members, we have about 200 people on there.
That's pretty rapid growth.
Very rapid growth. And the enthusiasm we're seeing from people, millennials and Gen Z, to the realization that the effects of the climate crisis are immediate. Mm-hmm. We can see that temperatures have been rising and that we're regularly experiencing heat waves. Some people may think that Kansas City, we're free from those effects. We're free from the effects that maybe sea level rise will cause, but we're not actually free from the effects. As a matter of fact, the Weather Channel rated Kansas City number 5 out of a list of 25 cities most affected by the climate crisis.
Yeah. Cole, how about you? How big has Citizens Lobby become here in Kansas City?
It's hard to measure because we generally reach out to people and tell them to write letters to the representatives and tweet at them, call them, and we don't know how many people have done that. As far as our chapter goes, there's probably about 20 of us
yeah.
that regularly show up to the meetings. And our goal, we are pretty much laser focused on passing the Carbon Fee and Dividend Act. So we reach out to as many people as possible. As far as a quantity of letters that have been sent, I don't know that off the top of my head.
And what about your own everyday life? I've asked that question about biking to work. You said it's probably too far, but showering mm-hmm. less, hanging up the laundry instead of running it through the dryer. What kinds of things are you doing?
You know what? I could probably hang up my laundry, and I don't do it.
Yeah.
So I should probably
That's
get
a hard one.
Yeah, yeah. And Sierra here is definitely going to inspire me to go do that.
Yeah.
But no, I do still use the dryer.
Yeah, how about you, Emily?
Yeah, you know, I try to make individual changes throughout the day. I was actually in Cape Town, South Africa, during the drought 2 years ago, and really saw firsthand what it's like to not really be able to take a full shower every day.
Wow.
And really, really have to ration all the water you use. I hope, you know, it doesn't come to that point in Kansas City, but I know that lifestyle changes are absolutely important. I also,
that's really hard for people. Maybe it's easier for younger folks, but when you talk to people, you know, my age, you know, changing lifestyles like hanging the laundry out to dry, that's a tough one.
It is. Yeah. But like I said, I was really frustrated on the limitations of my individual action, especially when calculating my carbon footprint and where it comes from. I get on a plane pretty often for work and for personal factors.
And that's become a hard one for you, I've read.
Absolutely. My sister's wedding is 2 weeks away in New York. And when I take that flight, most of the other changes that I've made in my life will probably be negated, unfortunately. I will put as much carbon in the atmosphere from my own individual contributions on that flight as somebody in Pakistan or dozens of other countries are responsible for in an entire year.
Yeah.
So just by means of getting where I have to go, and I can't not go to my sister's wedding, mm-hmm. I do have a large carbon footprint. And that's why, you know, taking those individual actions that I do in my everyday life, I think are very important. But I also want there to be a day where when I go to New York for maybe my sister's daughter's wedding, I don't have to put a whole metric ton of carbon
right.
in the atmosphere. I can get there in a way that's much cleaner. And that's not going to necessarily happen based on my individual actions. It's going to happen based on our systematic change.
I'm wondering even about something broader, the idea of having kids. Does that have you wrestled with that idea, Sierra? Is that, you know, in your future, given what the planet might look like 20 or 30 years down the road? How are you sizing that up?
Yeah, it's actually was a very serious consideration for me. And as I had said before, I was actually a homeowner. I was also a car owner. I'm currently car free, and I live in a 425 square foot studio apartment on Broadway. And those changes I've made are in direct connection with the fact that we have an uncertain future that we're dealing with, and that it is going to require individuals to make a collective decision about how we choose to live in the future.
Having kids in your future?
I myself have decided that it's time. I have to put these decisions off, especially because I see that the inaction that's happening within society to really wrestle this is something that we as millennials and we as Gen Z are going to have to face. That, and I do know people that are choosing not to have kids, and I am one of those people that is holding off.
Cole, how are you wrestling with that?
With the question of kids, I'm wrestling with it in that I'm open to adopting in the future because I understand that a lot of children will be offset by global warming and climate change, to be politically correct. But I am not married, so that's going to be a decision between my spouse and I.
Yeah.
But I am certainly open to adopting and understand that that could be a necessity in the future.
Emily, you've wrestled with this. You told our producer as much. What about having kids in your future?
I mean, I think, you know, growing up in the 90s, we all had this thought that, or what we were taught, was every generation was promised a better life than the generation before. I don't feel 100% confident that that would be true for a child I would have today. But I do feel some hope in the not-so-long future. I hope that in the not-so-long future, when I do want to have kids, I can do that in a more hopeful time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I'm involved right now, because I still do want to have kids and I want to give them an earth that can sustain them. And I'm hopeful that the political climate will change in the next few years and that I can have children. But I have a lot of anxiety around it, for sure.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking with millennials and some Gen Z folks about the future with climate change and how it's impacting their lives. If you want to join our conversation, our number here, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. What about this idea of hope for the future? Sierra, what do you think? I mean, Emily is hoping for a better days ahead. How hopeful are you?
Yes, I see the fact that every crisis can be made into an opportunity. And for us, the crisis we face is the climate crisis. But the opportunity we have is not just to reduce and reverse the effects that are happening now and will be devastating in the future should we choose not to act. But the opportunity is to lift Americans out of poverty, to create a new economy around green technology using the Green New Deal. This is something that will revolutionize how we live, how our society interacts and communicates. And that feeling of hopefulness is something that I really, you know, I haven't experienced in a while, not since I would say Barack Obama became president, and that real sense of hopefulness that I received knowing that we're turning the effects around. Unfortunately, the past couple of years have not been good for climate activism, but we are growing in our movement, the Sunrise Movement. We're reaching out to people. There's a climate strike on September 20th that high school students and college students are all committing to doing a walkout on their campuses, including Amazon workers are doing a walkout September 20th in order to raise our voice and what we need to do to address the climate crisis.
Lots of phone calls here. Let's go to some of them now. Jan from Kansas City North. Jan, you're on Up to Date. We're talking with some young folks about climate change. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, and I really applaud that people are getting activated, and good to you. I had a comment concerning the lines, clotheslines, and things like that. HOAs often do not allow clotheslines, for instance, and have really strict things about your yard cutting. Cities do too. We, I think, need to liberalize that so that clotheslines are allowed, and also, you know, don't make your lawn cutting requirements so, you know, right, so strict. Because right, and as along with that too, we need to maybe cut back on watering lawns, which I've never done. And clothesline, if you are not in an apartment, it's not all that hard, really, and it's very nice to get yourself out into the open air. If you're in an apartment, it's not really great, but you can always use one of those clothes racks in your bathtub.
Right, right.
And things like that, and that's very helpful.
All right. Jan, thank you for the good call. I appreciate it. You know, some of our older listeners, you know, might be surprised that the three of you feel as strongly as you do. Arguably, there's a generational divide here on this issue. Am I right about that? Have you sensed that much, Cole?
Yeah, I believe so. And I mean, I think the Boomer and Gen X generation just are more used to living the life they lived, and they grew up and spent most of their careers believing that what they were doing was good and there were no problems. But we are seeing that our way of life is causing catastrophic climate change, not yet, but eventually. And we are just not as used to being in the flow. So
yeah,
we're emerging and we see that. And so I think we're just more receptive because we're younger.
Emily, you're nodding your head. I'm wondering about how you and your parents deal with this.
Yeah, I mean, so the data shows that as well. We look at the voters that support carbon fee and dividend, and about 2/3 of Americans do support that. If you break it down by age group and by political category, Democrats are 80% support carbon fee and dividend, Republicans 53%. But if you look at Republicans under 40, they look like Democrats. 75% support carbon fee and dividend. So there really is a general divide. Thinking about my parents and their lifestyle and my own lifestyle, I had a very happy childhood. We lived in the woods and really burned a lot of gas getting to where we needed to go. And I dream about that future for my children, but also know that the world is changing and that people in my generation are looking for ways that they can raise families or live their lives and not be as much of a burden on the planet. And I, you know, we don't blame the older generation because not a lot of this was really you know, known to the general population, but now we do know, and now we have to take action for the decades and decades before us that have put so much pollution into the air.
Let's go back to some calls, and Maria from Mission on the Kansas side. Maria, good morning.
Good morning. Steve, I have a question for you that I'd like to pose, and that is, why for you is it so difficult to make the transition from sticking your clothes in the dryer versus hanging them on a rack to dry?
Just haven't done it for a lot of years. My mom used to do it, Maria, but we haven't done it.
So the thing that's difficult is that you just haven't done it?
Right.
Okay, so you can go on Amazon, you can go over to Aldi, get a drying rack for $10, and it's really easy.
I have no doubt, Maria.
You'd actually give that a try. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that so much of this is an education component. If we're looking at how to reduce footprint, one of the biggest changes you can make is in your diet and just eating less meat. And that sometimes we don't think of the upstream and downstream implications of the choices we make.
Right. Maria, I'm glad you called. Thanks for the good advice. I appreciate it.
Good thing.
You know, Cole, you have said you're working to become a certified solar installer.
That's true.
What are you thinking about?
Okay, well, I have taken classes to become a certified solar installer. However, I am not in that industry. I work for a general contractor, and what we do is the whole building, not just the solar panels on top. And it's funny you mentioned that because nobody I work with knows that I've been doing that. The reason I've been doing that is because I just feel this drive to do something that is helpful to solve this problem. And I think putting up solar panels is a direct reduction in carbon emissions, however small a scale you put them up. So I've been working on that with the plan of doing it as a side job, apart from general contracting, and maybe using the knowledge of solar in general contracting to convince customers to go solar and build net carbon neutral buildings, which is hard to do because solar panels are expensive.
I was going
to
say, people think of solar panels and they think that costs a lot of money, right?
It does. Pardon me. It does. And, you know, some customers are more conservative and, you know, they think if you're trying to push solar panels on them, you're trying to get them to waste their money. Yeah. And that's not true.
Right.
I mean, solar panels pay off even if it does take 10 years.
Right. We go back to some calls. David from Overland Park. David, you're on the air.
Thank you. Listen, I'm a little concerned here about all the pessimism that's being expressed. And I just want to say that America is making great strides in producing a cleaner environment. I'm astonished that they're not aware of that. There's really such great work being done. Nobody in their right mind wants a polluted environment. And the real problem...
But David, America still has a long way to go, though, doesn't it, when it comes to coal and everything else?
Well, yeah, it does. But we're working on... the green train has left the station and is not coming back. And that's the very good news here. But it's going to take a long time. But we are very conscious. And I'm talking about the business community. The business community is very conscious about this problem, and they're moving heaven and earth to things like carbon sequestration and carbon capture and sequestration.
Well, let me get a comment from our guests here. Are you guys being too pessimistic about the future, Emily? What do you think?
You know, I think there is a lot of hope for the future, and you're right. We have so many exciting innovations right now that can help us move to clean energy. The reality is, though, in 2018, carbon emissions in the U.S. rose by 3.1%. So we're still not going in the right direction overall in what we're producing as a country. But I am hopeful, and I do share that there is a lot of optimism in the plans that we have for the future, including carbon fee and dividend, making the fossil fuels that we use more expensive so that we want to buy Kohl's solar panels and we want to create an economy that's not as dependent on fossil fuels.
I think it's fair to say our president is supporting continued coal and oil exploration, rolling back EPA restrictions, and the like.
Yeah, and there's so many opportunities for alternatives. So I really appreciate that caller for bringing that in. And I just want to say, if anybody is interested in telling their congresspeople that they do support carbon fee and dividend, or just learning more about it, you can go to our website at KCCCL, so that's KCCCL.org, and find out about Citizens Climate Lobby and all of the great plans that really are in place to keep us moving in a right direction.
But okay, we're going to wrap it right there. I want to thank, that was the voice of Emily Hurley with the Kansas City chapter of Citizens Lobby, Cole Strickland with the same group, Sierra West belongs to the Sunrise Movement, KC. Thank you all for a good conversation. Appreciate
thank
it very
you.
Much. Thanks
Appreciate
for your insights.
It.
Yeah.
Thanks.
When we come back, we'll talk with our ethics professors about NFL football and how ethical is it that so many fans support a sport that continues to expose its participants to all kinds of risks when it comes to their health and livelihoods. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. You can get my newsletter, Kraske Off Mic, delivered directly to your inbox every Monday. Sign up at kcur.org/Kraske and prepare yourself for fresh weekly words from me and highlights of the work we do here each day. Go to kcur.org/Kraske and subscribe. Tomorrow on the show, with 300 million guns already in circulation across the country, is it too late to make a dent in the number of gun deaths? We'll learn why one constitutional law expert says our approach to gun control and gun rights needs a rebalancing. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the NFL season came roaring back to its regular season life this weekend, with the Chiefs notching a big win in Jacksonville. The openers came a short time after Colts quarterback Andrew Luck announced his retirement at age 29, citing the cycle of injury, pain, and rehab that has become his professional life as the reason. So here's a question. What ethical responsibilities do fans have in continuing to support a sport that risks its participants' health and life? When a big question like that looms, we bring in the ethics professors, and once again, they are Wayne Vaught. He's the provost at Utah Valley University and formerly the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at UMKC. Wayne, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Great to be here.
And Clancy Martin is a professor in the Department of Philosophy at UMKC and a professor of business ethics at the Block School of Management. Clancy, always good to have you here, too.
Thanks for having us, Steve.
You know, you hear this kind of talk sometimes that NFL fans are culpable for supporting a sport that can maim and result in injuries that prove debilitating later in life. Clancy, what are the ethics of supporting a sport that can have such a, you know, devastating impact on its players?
Well, I think that it is fair to say that fans do have some culpability for the practices.
Encouraging it,
absolutely. It isn't the case that we want to stop sporting activities that involve risk, because we believe in, you know, the basic freedoms of people to do what they want to do. And that, of course, includes athletes, and perhaps particularly includes people who's in their professional lives. And these athletes all have professional lives. On the other hand, we also have involvement insofar as we are supporting these activities, and we can make reasonable changes that we feel good about, that we'd feel good about our children participating in this activity or ourselves participating in this activity. So as fans, I think our obligation is to increasingly push, in this case, the NFL, to refine the rules that are in place for the protection of the players. Mm-hmm. And so to ask for improvements in equipment, to ask for as necessary changes in rules.
And arguably that's happening, right?
Yeah,
there have been any number of changes on both fronts in recent years.
Yeah, due to the very unfortunate fact of all of the brain injuries that these players have been suffering for years and years and years, and the very happy fact that the media is paying attention and is getting all of us to pay attention to it, I think the owners are being forced to deal with a situation that they've known about for a long time,
right,
and that is clearly ethically unsupportable. And, you know, we have seen in a variety of sporting activities over the course of centuries and years, people realizing, okay, this is starting to look a little bit barbaric. The norms of our civilization is changing.
Right.
We have some responsibility to change the games in accordance with our expectations for people's well-being.
You know, Wayne, centuries ago, gladiators used to fight to the death in the arena, that kind of thing. We wouldn't put up with a sport that does that any longer. And arguably, football isn't that far removed from that.
Yeah, I think football is close in some ways. I think other sports, boxing, kickboxing, and other types of things come sometimes even closer, where you got a lot of violence, a lot of blood, a lot of injuries that can result from that. And there has been a centuries-long fascination with violence, with
yes,
these types of behaviors. That on the one hand, we stand back and say it's unethical to inflict pain and injury and suffering on another human being, yet at the same time we are so fascinated that we have for centuries, from the Colosseums to our current Colosseums, sports and activities that place other human beings at significant risk. And the question is, one part obviously is how much responsibility do the fans have for putting money into an organization that promotes such violence? But secondarily, I mean, I don't think your average fan even recognizes or appreciates just what those risks have been. And so that's coming to light, and it does put you in a very interesting ethical perspective, as to say, well, if I know that I'm putting money into an organization, if it were killing children or some other thing, you would
right,
think this would be morally abhorrent, and I would have some culpability for how my money is being used. And so I do think it puts you in a position of the paying fan of making sure that we're holding the owners accountable, the leagues accountable,
right,
for the safety of the people who are involved.
You know, Leslie tweeted us this, and I was wondering if our other listeners feel the same way. She writes this: I used to be a huge football fan and grew up with it, but I stopped supporting all levels of this exploitive sport after the concussion risks were revealed. I'm wondering again, 816-235-2888, do you feel the same way? Or tweet us at KCUR up to date. What do you make of all that? You know, Clancy, the flip side of the coin here, if there is a flip side, is that the participants certainly are aware of the risks these days. You know, they know what they're getting themselves into. How much of that this mitigates a fan's responsibility here?
Well, one of the nuances is certainly the question of what counts as exploitation. So, and that's why we might be particularly worried about professional sports as opposed to amateur sports. Because in professional sports, what you're doing is you're taking young people who we all know, having been young people ourselves, are particularly prone to the attractions of a whole lot of money, a whole lot of fame, a whole lot of attention, and getting them in kind of a vulnerable point in their development and, well, frankly, manipulating them through forces that we can all understand without giving them kind of the longer view of what these injuries eventually, how these injuries eventually might impact their lives and not only shorten their professional careers, but influence their futures in all kinds of negative ways.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, one hopes that older players are talking to the younger players and saying, hey, these are things you need to think about. And as the media has been doing a good job at calling all of our attention to this, it's been having a therapeutic and helpful impact. But, you know, when you're 18 years old and somebody's throwing a whole lot of money at you,
yeah,
and
absolutely,
you understand, okay, well, I might only be able to do this for 3 years, but in those 3 years, I can make $5 million or something like that. I mean, this is sort of inherently exploitative. Now, what can we as fans, and then also what can we demand from the owners and from the leagues? I think much greater degrees of education, more thought about the way in which particularly young players are being played, involving them more in the process of determining what the likelihood of these particular injuries is going to be. Mm-hmm. All of these kinds of things will, and then, of course, you know, thinking about equipment and rules, all of these things will reduce the impact of what might be an inherently exploitative practice.
Right. You know, the NFL clients, Wayne, in theory, could put a rule in place that says players can only play for 4 years or 5 years to reduce this possible exposure, but that would be a fairly dramatic move.
Well, I think it would, and it would be one that could potentially impact their bottom line significantly. Some positions, some players are able to play for 10 years and do well. Other positions are more vulnerable to abuse. So, you know, it's difficult. I think they would probably, you know, whether you go position by position or whether they're inclined to do that. I think, you know, putting it on the leagues, there is also sort of the social responsibility that these are organizations that work within a civil society. And it may be that there needs to be legislation around this and more restrictions placed on the leagues. It just doesn't seem that they're willing to take that full step themselves, though they have. I mean, there have been new rules every year that come out that are specifically designed to protect players from significant injury. And so that's a move in the positive direction. But I think that, you know, if we do have these really compelling ethical concerns, it's probably going to take some step above and beyond the leagues themselves to get those implemented. And I think that society and fans will have somewhat of a negative reaction of a government stepping in and regulating what they see as their right to engage in these sort of sporting activities.
Hey, let's go to Mike from Kansas City, Kansas. Mike, you're on Up to Date.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Basically, it's in human nature. You know, the two things they always say they talk about that you're never going to get out of the brain is basically hardwired in is the sex and violence. So this is the violent aspect of it. So any way to water it down or, like, make it tag football for professional guys, it's not going to go over. There's people want to see that stuff. Personally, I don't, you know, but I mean, I'm a motorsports fan, and I know people can get killed in that, but at least not they're trying to 275-pound guys running at each other and colliding. I'll take my comment off there. Thank you.
Yeah, I understand the fact that we're hardwired for sex, but what about being hardwired for violence, Clancy? Does that sound right to you?
Well, I think that the question of what our animal nature is, is not so much, might be relevant to the discussion, but the fact is that as we increasingly civilize, we civilize into the control of these so-called animal impulses. And we're not in the business of encouraging them. We're not in the business of saying, okay, well, these have to be released in a particular way. We are in the business of saying, how should we responsibly treat one another? And we talk about that in the context of sex quite a lot, too.
Right, right.
And here we have a situation where we can say concrete harms are being done. I think Wayne makes a very good point that businesses tend to be, when there's a lot of money involved, they tend to be very bad at regulating themselves. So external regulation is commonly necessary for all kinds of profit-seeking enterprises. And external regulation may be necessary here so that we can say whether or not we enjoy violence, enjoying violence in this situation is inappropriate.
Right.
You know,
right.
Play a video game if you need to enjoy some violence.
You know, Wayne, it's interesting to me. You don't get a sense that people want to talk about this too much. We've just had one caller here on a topic that is, you know, about the lifestyles of so many people here. It's a tough one for people.
Well, I think it is because there is this conflicting desires. I mean, I like football. I like to watch football. I think, you know, you see the replays, the hard hits, the aggressiveness. There's something like a car accident or something that draws your attention. You're just sort of drawn to it. And you talk about that hardwired nature. I think that there is a, for many people, not all, but for many people, there's this certain level of either enjoyment or just you're just sort of drawn to that. And then you take a step back and you say, but wait a second, there are people whose lives are being dramatically changed, injured in ways that you have this conflicting emotional, hopefully emotional response, a sense of conscience that I shouldn't be wanting to see this, but I can't help myself. I want to do it. And so that's where, you know, you kind of have to, I think, take a step back in a neutral way and get people in a rational, calm environment to think, okay, well, what is it acceptable for us to allow rational, free agents to engage in, even with some level of risk? So we're not going to outlaw rock climbing, I don't think, even though there's real risk of injury with that. But this is a venue within that area where there are competing human desires and demands, and we just have to figure out how do we balance those two.
Well, let's turn to a different topic, the ethics of protest. There's a lot of protests going on around the globe these days, be it Washington or various state capitals or in Hong Kong. But how far can you go to make your views known without crossing an ethical line? And the overriding question, are there any issues so important that any means are justified in getting the message out? Let's start with that point. Is there ever a time when any means is justified to make a point? Clancy, what do you think?
I don't think that we want to, if we're talking about the ethics of a particular practice, I don't think we ever want to say any means are justified, because there are some practices where we will say, well, this is just always unacceptable. You know, for example, some people sometimes talk about a terrorist being put in a position of such political oppression that she or he was only able to make her concerns heard through violence. And we can say that may be the case, and yet we still want to say that the violence you have propagated was immoral. You know, it may have been your only way of doing it. Nevertheless, it was immoral. It was it was not morally justified. You might say it was politically justified or justified in some other way, but it's not morally justified. It was wrong. When there is the lesser of two evils, the lesser of two evils is still an evil, in short. Now, when it comes to this question of justifiable protests, the way I like to think about this and the way I like to talk to my students about it is, for most of us, when we feel like we are doing something morally justified, we are willing to own that. So I will say, yes, this I have done this. It is a morally justifiable or even praiseworthy thing. And look, it is I who have done it.
Mm-hmm.
But if the only way you are willing to engage in an activity is anonymously, then your moral hackles should probably be raised. You should probably be asking yourself, am I really engaged in a morally justifiable practice if I will only do this anonymously? Now, there are circumstances like, for example, the Hong Kong protests, when you say, okay, we've got an oppressive government here. These people are going to be going to jail for something that we feel like is morally important, and in they're preserving their anonymity in order to be able to continue to protest and obviously not to get thrown in jail by an oppressive government.
Right.
But even in those circumstances, if you look at our moral exemplars, Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., Socrates, we say these fellows insisted on not being anonymous, on taking the consequences of their moral decisions, because they recognized the fact that this was morally urgent and that an individual could be sacrificed for it. So I would recommend that we be particularly suspicious of protest that is anonymous.
That's interesting. There's a 12-question protest ethics checklist on the website ethicsalarms.com, Wayne. And one of the questions is the means of protest appropriate to the objective? That strikes me as a pretty good question.
Well, I think it's fundamental to the question, because what a protest is a component of a civil society and a social contract. And so Hobbesian and other philosophers we've talked about on the radio before would acknowledge that there are certain circumstances, certain extreme circumstances where the resort to any means would be appropriate if one's finding oneself in a state where giving up the rights and privileges that one has in order to create the social contract now are so onerous that it's no longer worth staying in that. So, you know, if it's protesting a sex trafficking types of activities and it was necessary to help people escape, I think that you could argue that protests up to including the killing of other people might be justifiable because the threat is so great. I mean, if you were able to, you know, find a situation where you could go in and you had these women who were being sex trafficked and were being enslaved, and it was necessary to in order to free them, that you wouldn't just raise a protest. You would actually inflict bodily harm. You could argue, I think, in that case, that could be justified. In most cases that we're talking about protests and in terms of civil society, I think the purpose of the protest should be to promote positive change.
Yeah.
And if the purpose of the protest is simply to inflict harm or simply to cause disruption, then you're raising some different set of ethical concerns. But I think that there can be an elevated level of protest that could up to and include bodily harm, depending on what exactly it is that you're facing.
Clancy, do you buy that, this idea of bodily harm being one possible outcome of a justifiable protest?
Well, I think there's a distinction that we want to make between bodily harm being a possible outcome, which you might say, okay, this is a risk worth taking, and actually inflicting bodily harm as the means of protest, which is where I would draw the line and say, look, there must be another way to protest rather than inflicting bodily harm. Now, and if inflicting bodily harm is the only way you can find to protest, I would say, well, you've actually done something wrong there. You may feel like it was the lesser of two evils, but it's still morally blameworthy.
Even in the case of human trafficking, as Wayne talks about?
Well, I think, Wayne, I don't necessarily agree with the example, because I think that Wayne was saying, well, you might need this in order to change the practice. Right. Okay, bodily harm in order to change certain practices, that is clearly necessary sometimes. War, for example, all kinds of examples we could give. But that's a little bit different than a protest, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Protest is a sort of raising one's voice against something. And I would like to think that there are lots of good ways of protesting sexual enslavement or something like that, other than inflicting bodily harm, even though changing the practice itself might require something more than protest, like putting people in jail.
And let me just echo that.
I got about 30 seconds,
Wayne. Clancy's pretty much captured. I'm not advocating for violence and protest by any means, just that there are certain types of situations where there could be enslavement that someone, to get out of that, could be justified in harm. In most of the civil protests we're talking about, I concur with what Clancy has said in terms of the not doing it to inflict harm.
We'll have to leave it right there. Those are the voices of our ethics professors, Wayne Vaught, provost at Utah Valley University, Clancy Martin, a professor in the Department of Philosophy here at UMKC. Gentlemen, always appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Steve.
On yesterday's program, we learned how universities in Missouri are recruiting new students to become future teachers. Turns out, it's quite a challenge. You can listen to that and other previous conversations. You'll find them at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, acclaimed actor and Kansas City native Nathan Darrow fills us in on his current endeavor. That's a big role in Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR UpToDate. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.